Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Say what you will about the healthcare reform law, but there is no doubt it is changing the face of the private healthcare industry. Today, another big insurance merger to serve what's expected to be a large influx of new customers, otherwise known as patients. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 20th of August. It is time to talk about another giant healthcare deal. Insurers buying insurers, to be specific. In July, WellPoint snapped up Amerigroup for $5 billion, and today Aetna announced it is swallowing rival Coventry Healthcare for $5.7 billion. Open wide and say, ah. Dan Gorenstein of New Hampshire Public Radio reports these insurance giants are pulling out their checkbooks because a whole lot more people are about to get insured.
Aetna says scooping up Coventry will double its Medicaid members, and considering that many states may add Medicaid patients under the healthcare law, that's a big deal, says the Urban Institute's John Holohan.
If every state expanded to cover Medicaid, it would be $931 billion between 2013 and 2022. It's a lot of money.
Angling for more government business, namely Medicaid and Medicare, is becoming routine for insurance giants. Both WellPoint and Cigna have bought up smaller companies in the past year, but Duke business professor Peter Ubel says healthcare reform isn't the only reason.
It is a consolidation battle, almost, between insurers and hospitals.
Ubel explains big means leverage. In recent years, hospitals have been buying up medical practices to gain clout in negotiations with insurers. Now, insurers are bulking up. Ubel says that could be a good thing for you and me.
Normally, you'd think that the fewer insurance companies there were, the more expensive insurance would be because they'd have more monopoly power. But what they're often doing is going to hospitals and negotiating lower rates, and that might allow them to offer less expensive insurance.
What's the right mix of mammoth insurance companies and behemoth hospital networks? Ubel says no one knows. But he says when it comes to health insurance consolidation, while big doesn't necessarily mean good, it doesn't necessarily mean bad either. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
It is vacation time in Europe, but Greek ministers are not in a holiday mood. Today they're meeting to hash out billions more dollars in spending cuts demanded by their European partners as a condition for getting more bailout money. The Greeks have fallen behind in implementing reforms and austerity measures. With us from Thessaloniki, Greece's second city, is Marios Eftimiopoulos. He's with the research firm Strategy International. Welcome.
Thank you.
So it is vacation season there in Greece and throughout Europe, but are Greeks thinking about the economic crisis or about vacation?
I think they're thinking a bit of both, and I think they're going on vacation in order to avoid talking or thinking about the financial crisis.
Yeah. Are there many tourists from outside of Greece there?
Foreign people are coming to Greece, foreign tourists are coming to Greece, but of course they're much lower numbers than they were last year or 2 years ago.
Any speculation on why that is? Why aren't people there?
I think it's it's this negative attitude between everybody and this climate that has been developing for the last year and a half that has brought Greece basically to a standstill, to what it had to do with its tourism. There are those that are coming every year in Greece, and they keep on coming in Greece because they kind of like it. So they don't care what is told, they don't care what's going on, what they just care is just, having a nice time in Greece and relaxing.
Before the summer, we talked to one man in Greece who said that there would be blood on the streets if Greeks had to go through austerity. And certainly there was some rioting a while ago, but it seems like things have settled down. Society has certainly not broken down. Why is that? Have Greeks just resigned themselves to this as a fact?
Greeks, when Greeks are told to decide either left or right or up or down, they kind of take it very bad in their own way. So we have this tendency of getting it to the extreme that if something is going to happen, then the war will erupt and we'll take the guns and hit the streets and so on and so forth. This did not, of course, happen.
As you know, yesterday the German finance minister said that Germany would like to help but cannot be throwing money into a bottomless pit. Yes. Can't imagine Greeks are terribly happy about being called a bottomless pit.
Greeks don't take it well, but to be honest, they have also a right to feel like this because the messages from Greece that are taking outside are mixed. There's no clear position and opinion. They're not clear statements on what they would like to do. And me personally, as a Greek, I would like to see Greece deciding for one objective and going towards this. What will you export? What will you provide as services? How will you be identified to the international community? And that is a question that Greece has not faced since its entrance to the European Union.
Marios Eftimiopoulos is with Strategy International, and we spoke with him from the city of Thessaloniki. Thank you so much.
I thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much.
The Augusta National Golf Club Green Jacket is about to downsize and perhaps get an on-trend peplum at the waistline. Okay, that last part, I just made that up. But the jacket is about to get its first ever female fittings. Two, to be precise, for former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and financier Darla Moore. They will be the first women members in the club's 80-year history. But what does it cost to join such an exclusive club, and what's the return on investment? Sabri Benashour reports.
So that green jacket reportedly costs about $250 to make. That's an estimate, mind you. The manufacturer wouldn't say how much they go for, although at auction they've gone for around $7,000. Of course, to get the jacket, you have to be a member of Augusta. It's said that the initiation fee will run you up to $30,000. Nobody outside the club knows, and the club's not saying. Throw in monthly dues, and that jacket could cost around $40,000. But what's it really worth?
The value is truly incalculable.
Lauren Stiller-Raclean is the president of the Raclean Institute for Strategic Leadership. She says, first of all, look at who's a member already. T. Boone Pickens, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, the most successful business people of our time.
I think there's tremendous access to business opportunities. I mean, I find, and that I'm particularly fascinated by, is the extent to which with men, opportunities happen in a social or recreational setting.
And then there's just bragging rights.
A valuable intangible.
Howard Anderson teaches at MIT. He remembers an investment firm that was paying Henry Kissinger $1 million just to have lunch with executives and their clients.
And I once said to the investment banking firm, my God, what could Henry Kissinger ever say at lunch that's worth $1 million a year?
The answer? Anything. If being a client meant saying you had lunch with Henry Kissinger. Anderson says people would pay millions for that little green jacket just for that. I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, seems like a market-wide summer vacation with all three major indices flat for the day. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The newspaper world is still grappling with enormous changes to its industry, prompted in most part by the internet. Most recently, several papers, including the New Orleans Times-Picayune and three in Alabama, announced they would cut circulation to fewer than 7 days a week and shift their focus to online news delivery. But there are plenty of people out there who don't want to get their news online. Folks like Susan Lira, a 40-year subscriber to the Birmingham News.
I was in shock. I really and truly thought whoever made this decision had lost their mind.
So what becomes of those who prefer print to pixels? Gigi Dubin reports from Birmingham.
When a newspaper goes digital and prints less, hardcore readers clinging to their daily papers are fresh out of luck.
That's the tough part. And those are the people who are writing the letters to the editor that are appearing every week in the newspaper.
That's Hunter George, retired executive editor of the Birmingham News.
They feel hurt, they feel let down, and they're going to miss 7 days a week of a newspaper. But you know, the world is changing.
So newspaper publishers are trying to change too, shifting to digital platforms. Cutting back on print while not eliminating it entirely, George says, is a bold experiment. And it's one that other newspaper publishers will watch closely.
If this works here in Alabama and in New Orleans, you're going to see newspaper companies all over America asking themselves whether they need to publish 7 days a week.
When papers do scale back, they're sure to keep the heaviest advertising days, Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. And if traditional newspaper readers aren't thrilled, it's not that big a deal, according to Robert Picard, editor of the Journal of Media Business Studies.
Well, some readers will probably be lost, but essentially most newspapers today have already lost those people that aren't hardcore news readers.
The big question is whether a scaled-back staff can cover Birmingham's local scene. Among the three Alabama papers, 400 employees are being let go. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
One year ago this week, the Gaddafi regime fell in Libya. Political stability continues to elude the country. Over the weekend, bomb attacks in Tripoli killed 2 people, and today an Egyptian diplomat's car blew up in Benghazi. No one was hurt. But while Libya's economy has also struggled in the last 12 months, it is starting to find its footing. In fact, it's a growing market for U.S. exports. So what's it like to do business in Libya? Red River Radio's Kate Archer Kent has the story of a tiny Louisiana sawmill with an answer.
Lumber is being graded and stacked for shipment at a family-owned sawmill in the tiny town of Cachada, Louisiana. 24 million feet of lumber is manufactured here each year. It's stamped with Made in USA. Allman Brothers Lumber is an exporter. Much of this is destined for the Libyan port of Misrata.
We've done a lot to promote the southern yellow pine in that market.
The southern yellow pine from this mill, co-owned by William Almond, is used for things like exposed beams, window frames, and stair railings in Libya. Its golden color and natural grain appeals to customers there, and it holds up well in the Libyan climate. Almond has never been to the country. He works through approved agents in Switzerland and Austria who help get his goods to market. Through the years, he's developed a strong customer base before sanctions went into place in 1992 and after the U.S. lifted them in 2004.
We were shipping millions of feet back into Libya, became our number one country until Arab Spring hit.
Almond put his own money into the business last year to prevent laying off his 87 employees. That proved to be a good move. Libyan exports are picking up. Francisco Sanchez is the Undersecretary for International Trade at the Commerce Department. He says Libya needs goods and services that can be supplied by American companies.
Some of this is very, very basic that they're going to need. Power generation, water treatment, the kind of typical things that you would need in any municipality.
Libya's economy shrank last year during the unrest, but today Libya is one of the fastest-growing economies in the world. Independent Libyan scholar Ronald Bruce St. John says the country has money in the bank to start major infrastructure repairs. That's due in part to its rich oil reserves and assets hoarded by the Gaddafi regime that can now be spent.
I think trade and investment opportunities in Libya will multiply because there's enormous pent-up demand within Libya for the kinds of things that the United States and Western Europe can provide.
Things like southern yellow pine. William Almond says he used a lull during the holy month of Ramadan to beef up inventory. He's expecting to ship out hundreds of thousands of dollars of 2x4s in the coming weeks, and he's confident that his Libyan customers will make good on payments. I'm Kate Archer Kent for Marketplace.
Coming up, the effect of knowing what fellow employees get in their paychecks.
I have a colleague who's making a little less than me, who comes to me and says, I don't think you deserve more than I am making. And we're talking a difference of $1,000 a year.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street had a bumpy start, but the markets ended the day pretty much where they started. The Dow shrugged off 3 points, that is 0.03%, to finish at 13,271. The Nasdaq was off less than a point, 0.01% at 3,076. And the S&P 500 was flat, closing where it opened at 1418. The struggling electronics store Best Buy announced a new CEO, but its shares were discounted more than 10% after a possible buy-out attempt by its founder took a step back. Another big box retailer, Lowe's, reported lower earnings than a year ago and fell nearly 6%. Apple continued to dominate the tech sector, adding more than 2.5% to hit a new high. Bond prices were flat as the yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 1.81%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. A conference at the National Press Club looks at the impact of federal regulations on U.S. manufacturers. The U.S. increased its tropical Sandy Beach territory when Hawaii became the 50th state on August 21, 1959. Aloha. And in international history, on August 21, 1911, the Mona Lisa was stolen from the Louvre. But if you've been to Paris, you probably know that it wasn't gone long. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. The stagnant economy has crippled countless nonprofit museums and arts organizations over the last several years. Big donors and foundations can't commit as much cash, and local governments can't justify supporting culture when roads and schools and pensions are on the line. But the Detroit Institute of Arts is one of a few arts groups experimenting with a different way of fundraising. They've asked local taxpayers to chip in. Voters in three Michigan counties passed a tax increase known as a millage dedicated to supporting the DIA. Anne-Marie Erickson is chief operating officer at the museum and joins us now. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right. So this idea of millage, explain that for us.
It's a very small property tax for homeowners. Here in our area, a home that has a market value of about $150,000, those individuals will pay about $15 a year for this tax. Ultimately, though, with all three counties in the mix, it will reap $23 million annually for the Detroit Institute of Arts.
So how did you convince people, particularly in this day and age, and folks scattered around Metro Detroit, to vote yes on a new tax?
We were relentless. We just never let up. And this was an example of people really pulling together from various communities to say, this museum is important and we're going to support it.
Well, and when you say you were relentless, I've read reports that you all just basically got on the phones and started calling up homeowners, voters. What was the reaction like when you did?
We got on the phones. We did literature drops. We posted signs in people's lawns when they said, okay. I would say that most people were very supportive of the museum, and even people who didn't really support the idea of an additional tax were supportive of the museum. So that was a good place to begin from, and we would obviously try to convert those who were not supporting the tax, but when we couldn't do it, we thanked them. We encouraged them to vote, to express their opinion, even though it wasn't an opinion that we were really in agreement with. But we did want people to vote and to exercise that right.
How will this money be spent by the museum? Is this dedicated for a specific program? Is it part of the operating budget?
It's part of the operating budget, and the whole idea is that we will no longer have to fundraise three-quarters of our operating budget. So now our fundraisers can work in endowment. And in return for this investment from the citizens of Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties, we are offering them free museum admission. And that has proven to be incredibly popular since the election on August 7th. What you'll find with most museums is that admission revenue is a very small percentage of our budget. We are not one of the New York museums that can charge $20 admission. Our admission for an adult is $8. So it's a relatively small part of our operating budget, and the tax will more than make up for that loss. And quite honestly, just having more people in the building is very energizing, and it helps our restaurant revenues and our shop revenues.
How unusual is it to use an additional tax like this, a millage, to fund a community arts organization?
It is not completely unusual. There are other museums in the country that use this model. I believe St. Louis uses it, and I believe Minneapolis uses it as well. It is not unheard of here in the Detroit area. Our zoo is funded in much the same way.
Hmm. Anne-Marie Erickson is the Executive Vice President and COO of the Detroit Institute of Arts. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tess.
I dare you. The next friend or coworker you see, tell them how much you get paid. You couldn't do it, could you? It's about as taboo a subject as you can get in America. Many people will talk about their sex lives before they'll talk about the size of their paycheck. And that secrecy may be one reason pay can vary so much, sometimes in some pretty unfair ways.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
This week, the Wealth and Poverty Desk will try to end the mystery of what we get paid with a series we're calling Payday. Marketplace's David Brancaccio has the story.
It's not as fun as extreme snowboarding, but listen to this Colorado company.
Yes, we have what I like to call extreme transparency.
Amanda Bybee is the VP at Namaste Solar in Boulder. There's a lot of sunshine going on inside this solar power installation company. Every employee can see a spreadsheet listing what everybody else makes. Terry Lima, an accountant, looks at it all the time and sees quite a few folks paid more.
I don't feel shortchanged in any way. I also am grateful to know there's no backdoor deals, that I don't have to do some political something so that I can make more money for myself.
And Namaste is extreme in other ways. It's employee-owned. Every worker, including Surendra Tapa, the forklift driver, is privy to all the company's financials, including every permanent employee's pay rate. Given this culture, I figured people like Amanda Bybee, the VP, would tell me this transparency about salaries is all sweetness and light. But no.
I have a colleague who's making a little less than me, who comes to me and says, I don't think you deserve more than I am making. And we're talking a difference of $1,000 a year.
They worked it out and are buddies again. But CEO Blake Jones acknowledges these conversations are uncomfortable.
But it's worth having it be out in the open. It's worth facing the fears that you might have of talking about it.
Being clear on salaries makes good business sense, Jones says. It builds trust and also makes coworkers accountable. They notice if someone's getting paid to goof off. But the transparency is for inside the company. Tellingly, neither Jones nor Bybee talks about their pay rate outside the company.
The taboo around money may be our last standing taboo.
New York University financial sociologist Kate Zaloom says this explains one of the great mysteries. How is it that given wide gaps in income in America, everybody walks around thinking we're so equal?
Of course, everyone in America thinks that they're middle class, but the only way that someone who makes $12,000 a year and someone who makes $200,000 a year can assume that they are all in the same social category is by never actually revealing what they make to each other.
It's not just a social taboo. Many employers enforce this.
I am, in fact, prohibited from telling anyone how much I make contractually.
Had Zaloom worked not for NYU but for the University of California, we could look up her pay ourselves. The Sacramento Bee newspaper was able to put the salaries of California state employees onto a website for all to see. How's that make the workers feel, employees like UC Berkeley professor David Card?
I'm a labor economist, and for labor economists, we're always analyzing salaries. And so it's possible that I may be desensitized.
So, Professor Card, how much do you make?
My salary from the university is around $300,000 a year.
Wow, you didn't hesitate.
Well, you can look it up on the internet.
Card studied the effect of the salary website and found that fellow employees who noticed they were doing better than the average golden bear kind of shrugged. But people who were doing worse than their peers tended to be really upset.
Yeah, that's true. And that might be one of the reasons why many employers insist on pay secrecy as part of the deal of working there. And it's going to really make the lower wage people much less happy.
Yeah, my name is Maricruz Manzanares, and I'm senior custodian at UC Berkeley.
A custodian with more than 12 years' experience. She also now sits on the board of her service employees, Union Local. Together, we typed the salary website into my iPad. What does it say you're paid?
$34,493.10.
The pay is obviously no surprise for Manzanares, but as that $34,000 sits there, stark on the webpage, she thinks of her three children and how that salary doesn't leave much left over to pay for their college.
And how can I ask my kids to put more into something that me as a mother cannot even help them with?
But she sees there is power in getting salaries out into the open. Her union has used the website to prepare for contract negotiations.
Actually, it's good that somebody put this website out there so we can check. If we put Mr. Yudov's name in there, I'll show up.
Who?
The president of the university system, Yudov, Mark Yudov. Let's see.
What does it say?
$560,594.40.
So over $500,000.
This is only for him and his wife. My salary still have to be for my three children and me. So that's ridiculous.
Which gets us to the special case of executive salaries. Tomorrow we'll look at how companies decide what to pay those at the very top. In Berkeley, California, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
We asked whether you talk about how much you earn with family, friends, or coworkers, and more than 150 of you responded. One of you wrote, "My answer has always been and always will be, I make enough." Others told us they don't mind revealing their salary. You can read and hear those replies and tell us what you think at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, we've heard a lot in recent years about the disappearing middle class. Well, anyone attending either the Republican or Democratic national conventions will be able to watch it happen. The artists Nora Ligurano and Marshall Reese plan to install ice sculptures weighing in at more than 2,000 pounds with the words middle class in 4-foot-tall letters. Now, these conventions are in Tampa, Florida and Charlotte, North Carolina, meaning they will, of course, disappear in the heat. While the real middle class may be taking years to melt away, the sculptures will take anywhere from 6 to 24 hours. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sagged 3.5 points, a fraction of a percent. The Nasdaq was off less than a point, also a fraction of a percent. And the S&P 500 ended exactly where it started. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Liza Madry, and Jolie Podokis. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.